This is Amy Medling. I'm a certified health coach and founder of PCOSDiva.com, and welcome to another PCOS Diva podcast. And today I am really honored to have Dr. Philip Golia with us today. He is the founder of Performance Fitness Concepts. It's one of the elite performance nutrition and wellness clinics in the U.S. Dr. Golia holds a PhD in nutritional science, and he's a graduate of Duke University, the American College of Sports Medicine, and the National Academy of Sports Medicine. His clients include not only pro and semi-pro athletes, but he also is the nutritionist of some of the stars from the Marvel Comics and stars like Chris Hemsworth, Chris Pratt, Ryan Gosling, just to name a few. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, I just want to tell everyone how I discovered you. I have a client who is also a client of yours, and she kept telling me that I had to read your book. You have a book out. It's called Turn Up the Heat, Unlocking the Fat-Burning Power of Your Metabolism. And I read your book, and it's fantastic, and it was a real eye-opener for me. As a health coach and working with hundreds of women with PCOS one-on-one and then through my online coaching program, what I have really found is that women with PCOS respond really well to an anti-inflammatory diet. When we take out foods that are really inflammatory for most of us, like gluten and dairy, and then adding in a lot of whole foods, a whole food-based diet with clean animal protein and healthy fats and lots of vegetables, that our PCOS symptoms seem to subside. But you know what? I think that we're all bio-individuals, that the mix of macronutrients, you know, your ratios of protein and carbs and fats, it's really different for each of us. And your book really kind of unlocks the key to figuring out what the right sort of ratio of those macronutrients are to rev up your metabolism, or as you say, to kind of turn up the heat. So I would love for you, let's start off by maybe you can kind of explain your idea of metabolic nutrition for the folks listening.
Well, it's pretty easy. We'll do a Reader's Digest version so we don't bury ourselves in the science of this. So there are three metabolic structures that exist. Either someone is fat and protein efficient or carbohydrate efficient, or they have a dual metabolism. Each three require certain macronutrient breakdowns. Like, for instance, myself, I'm fat and protein efficient. So my food program on a daily basis is 50% protein, 25% carbohydrate, and 25% fat. If you're dual, it's a third, a third, a third. If you're carbohydrate deficient, the majority of your food program comes from carbs, a small amount of fat, and then pretty much the balance in protein. So there are three structures. These three structures are determined by a health history, like a questionnaire that you could fill out, actually found within the book. Or the holy grail of determination is through the use of a lipid profile. Now, a lipid profile provides us with information like total cholesterol, HDLs, LDLs, triglyceride levels, and glucose readings. And it's easy to break these numbers down and ultimately see how your body manages fats, proteins, and carbohydrates so that you can type yourself. So we know that HDLs are good guy fats, and their job is to hunt down the bad guy fats and then convert them to energy and get them out of our body. So we want to have a lot of good guys in our system. So say, for example, I took your blood and you had a lot of HDLs. Let's say your number was 70 for an HDL. 35 is considered zero. Elite athletes are happy when they're 70 and over. You scored a 70 for an HDL. That's an incredible amount of HDLs, and you have a great capacity to utilize fat and protein efficiently. Then when you take that HDL and you divide it into your total cholesterol, you get a ratio. And I don't know, let's say your total cholesterol was in the high 180s or something, and we did the division, and we discovered that your ratio was under 4.5. Now, an average female In the United States, a healthy female sits at 4.5. A male sits at 3.5, and an athlete has a range of 2.1 to 2.8. And if we did your ratio, and if you were a 4.5 or less, that's very efficient as it relates to being a female, a healthy female. If your ratio were to sit in that 2.1, 2.8 zone, that's very athletic. And really, literally, that says, man, you could have any kind of physique you wanted as long as you followed the rules. Once looking at the ratios, then you take a look at LDLs, bad guy fats. And in bad guy fat world, there are levels. You want to have a bad guy fat of under 100. And if your fat number, if that bad guy fat LDL was under 100, it tells me that you are utilizing your fats efficiently. If the number sits between 100 and 130, that always tells me that you're not eating enough, that it's an environmental issue, that your foods are inconsistently patterned throughout your day. And then ultimately, if your LDLs sit between 130 and 160, it's a little bit of an environment and a little bit of genetics as it relates to a predisposition towards hypercholesterolemia. And then over the 160 mark, it always tells me that you're not managing fats well, that you have a genetic predisposition to hoard LDL fat, and you have a predisposition towards things like arteriosclerosis, things that promote plaque. And then finally, there's a third type of fat that floats around in you, and it's called triglyceride fat. Triglyceride fat does not come from eating fat. It comes from eating sugar, and it has a direct relationship with insulin response. And this is where PCS really finds its nest. So triglyceride fat is the storage form of sugar that sits in your liver, and it's a 3 to 5 day recall of sugars that you didn't use so well because of poor insulin response. So if you bake potato, for example, at some point it converts to glucose, and your brain will send a message to your pancreas and it'll say, hey, I just ate a potato, and I think I need like 20 insulin taxis to transport that sugar into my muscle to be used as an energy source. Would you please send me 20 taxis? Well, if your pancreas is smart, if it's not resistant, it will send you 20 taxis. You will utilize all of your sugar, and you will not store any as triglyceride fat. So your trig numbers will be low. They will be 110 or lower. But maybe your pancreas isn't so bright. Maybe it only sent you 10 insulin taxis, at which point you can only transport half of your sugar. The balance of the sugar is left to sit there. No one comes and gets it, and ultimately it is stored as triglyceride fat. These trig numbers, they go up and up and up and up. Before you know it, you're dealing with type 2 diabetes. So under 110 is what you want. Like my trigs sit around 48 or 45. They can be that low. If they sit between 110 and 145, that is always environmental, like under eating in your day and then loading sugars later in the day to keep you going, and then going to bed after that, at which point you will take that extra sugar that you consumed and you will store it as triglyceride fat. So that's just environmental, just more like an under-eating pattern. Now, the number could also sit between 145 and 175, at which point it's environmental and genetic, like a predisposition towards hyper and hypoglycemia. And then over the 175 mark is a full-on genetic marker for adult-onset diabetes. And as these trig numbers go up and up and up, 200, 500, 700, you know, 800, 900, you have these strong predispositions towards diabetes and an elevated HbA1c level. So those are the structures of all the numbers inherently found within your lipid profile. To determine your metabolic type, I think the easiest way to determine that, or to for an example, would be to take a look at diabetes and their family background. Let's say that you are so fearful of consuming fat, you've decided to go on a high-carbohydrate food plan. So you're afraid of fats, so you're not going to eat any fats, which means your protein intake will be low, and you're going to start a very Pekin-esque food program like your friend did, who maybe lost 20 pounds on a high-carb food plan. But in your family, there's this history of diabetes, this inability to manage sugars well. Is that a good food program or bad food program for you to start? You know, obviously you have a genetic sensitivity towards sugars, and you're about to start a food program that is high sugar. So you can guarantee that you'll be able to stay on it for a week or so, and then you'll start to crash and burn as your triglyceride levels elevate and you stimulate all these crazy cravings. And the same could be true if you are fat and protein deficient. So let's say you wanted to start a food program that was very Atkins-esque, very high fat, very high protein, and you were afraid of carbohydrate. So a friend of yours has lost, 15 pounds on an Atkins-type food program. You say, hey, I'm going to start that thing. I want to drop some weight too, but your dad, he died of a heart attack, You have very low HDLs, very high LDLs. You're a big-time plaque builder, yet you're starting a food program that's high fat, high protein. Now, is that a good idea or a bad idea? Not such a good idea. So maybe the sheer consistent caloric patterning of any food program will pull 5 or 10 pounds off you. But at some point, your body will rebel against in a food program that doesn't suit you, and then you'll start gaining your weight back and stimulating cravings. It's interesting in that you can eat really healthful food. Like you can say, and I have many patients that say, well, I don't eat McDonald's. I don't eat junk food. I eat healthy food. And I say, I completely agree with you, but are those foods designed in a particular nutrient pattern that best suits you? And they sit there and they look at me like a possum in headlights, like, what? What did you say to me? And I said, does it suit you? Like, everybody's different, and ultimately, there are three metabolic types that exist. Either someone is fat and protein efficient, carbohydrate efficient, or dual. Do you know the type that you are? Because though you might eat healthily, if you're eating foods that might be helpful but don't suit you in the correct macronutrient pattern, at some point, your body will adapt to protect itself, and you will hoard more fat than you should. So that's like the metabolic question. What type are you? And then really the next question is pretty simple. Do you eat enough food to actually convert fat to an energy source? And to a civilian, that sounds crazy. Like, what do you mean, eat enough food? What are you, crazy? I'm trying to diet here. I'm cutting back on my meals. You say to them, what you're telling me is you view food as adversarial. And they say, well, yeah, food's what got me here in the first place. It's made me fat. There, it's definitely adversarial. I feel like I'm in the middle of the Vietnam War here. And then you say, well, I don't know. Let's talk about metabolism for a second. Let's get a feel for what it really is. So you might say to a civilian, hey, do you think metabolism is hot or cold or fast or slow? What do you think it is? And generally we always hear, oh, I have a fast one. I have a slow one. My metabolism is so slow. And ultimately it's not. Metabolism is really hot or cold. And the reason why metabolism is hot or cold is because it is just a function of heat, because calories, the things we eat, are heat energy units. So calories are heat energy units. Your metabolism is a function of that heat. And then finally, fat will only convert to energy in a calorically hot environment. So now here's the question, and it will sound completely counterintuitive. How many calories do you have to eat a day to generate enough heat to utilize fat effectively as an energy source and repair your muscle? Now, I know that sounds counterintuitive, but let's pretend that we've lined up 20 of the best athletes in the world, and let's talk to them for a second. And we say to these athletes, hey, you guys, this week you have to give up something, training or food. What will you give up? And every athlete will say, I'll dump the training. I got to maintain my food. And then the civilian guy asking them that will say, that's nuts. I'm training my ass off. I'm trying to eat less. I'm trying to drop my weight. I'm working so hard at it. Food is making me fat. And then the athlete guy says to the civilian guy, he says, well, so I hear that you're training like crazy and you're trying not to eat. How's that working for you? And the civilian guy will always say, come to think of it, not so good. So if you pulled a big, huge guy, see, a 380-pound guy off of some, like, transit bus or something, or here in Santa Monica, walked up to him and said, man, you're huge. You obviously must eat a ton of food. He's going to look at you dead in the eye, and he's going to say, are you nuts? I have maybe two pairs of pants that fit, if you call this fitting. I look horrible in the pants that barely fit me, and I even look like more of a wreck out of my clothes. And I got a doctor that's up my ass about my cholesterol and my high blood pressure. Do you really think I overeat? What, are you crazy? So he might overeat at a particular meal because he underate all day long. But then back to that athlete guy, the athlete is saying, yes, exactly, you undereat because – when you train and you work out, you know, be it walking an hour a day, walking half an hour 3 days a week, going to the gym with weights, Pilates, whatever it might be, all of that action is nothing more than a breakdown of tissue, a catabolic event. And athletes, and when you train, you know, we all want to do that. We want to create that catabolic event, which is why we get a little sore. But then you don't want to keep it there. You want to stop it. You want to stick a wedge in that event, and you want to get to an anabolic event where the tissue repairs. Well, the wedge between the two events is nutrition, hydration, and recovery. And if it's the wrong size wedge calorically, like if there aren't enough calories in it to promote repair and muscular activity, if it's the wrong nutrient pattern that doesn't suit you, you will remain catabolic and waste, and in the process, hoard fat to protect yourself. Fat is held in a calorically cool environment. So you will always hoard fat if you're underfeeding. Like, you might lose some weight when you underfeed, but remember, like, if you make a size of your fist, so slightly larger than the size of your fist is 5 pounds of muscle. If you put five of those fists together, maybe even six, you have 5 pounds of fat. So fat is voluminous. It takes up a lot of room. Muscle is heavy and dense. It doesn't take up much room at all. Yes, you might lose some weight when you drop your calories and exercise a bunch, but you just lost the wrong kind of weight. And then you don't take up much less room in the room, you find out. And then you say, well, I'll diet even more. So you stop eating the one and only apple you have each day. And then you are so poorly repaired that literally at some point you bend over to pet your cat and your back goes out.
So yeah, I want to really emphasize what you said there, and because there's so many women that are out that really let the scale rule their lives. And if they're not seeing progress on the scale, then they throw in the towel.
Absolutely.
And what you said there was that, well, I'm just going to I just want to pull this out of your book just to kind of clarify. You say in your book, since fat is 4 times the volume of muscles, I always tell clients that their goal should not necessarily be to lose scale weight, but ultimately, as you said, to take up less room in the room. So if muscle weighs more than fat, a person should strive to weigh as much as possible per square inch, but to have few total square inches.
And yeah, scale, take up less room in the room, weigh as much as you can, right? Because ultimately, muscle is what supports your posture. Your spine doesn't, your muscle does. So you want to be heavy and dense. But at the same time of being heavy and dense, you want to take up less room in the room, which is why they have dress sizes, not dress weights. Not that I wear a dress, but I'm just saying.
I just think that's so, so important. And I want to say that I read your book in early winter, so probably like January, February, and I found out through doing the little quiz and looking at my lipid profile that I'm a dual metabolism, which I don't think a lot of women with PCOS are dual metabolism. I mean, this is just
no, they're mostly fat. Yeah. And, mostly fat and protein deficient, the women with PCOS.
I figured that I was not eating enough fat, and I grew up in that fat-free snack well era, that's what I like to call it.
Sure, that's right. High carbs.
High carbs, high sugar, and fat was evil. And I was not eating enough fat. I think I was kind of still a throwback from that era. So I really increased my fat so that it was more of an even percentage of macronutrients. And I can tell you that my energy has gone through the roof. And also, I was able to lose a little bit of, you know, women with PCOS, we have insulin resistance, and we have that excess kind of belly fat. And with that and doing Pure Barre workouts, like that is gone. And I really attribute it to adding more fat to my diet, which really for many of us sounds so counterintuitive. But maybe you could speak to PCOS and insulin resistance and the typical metabolic type that sort of follows along with that.
Let's do that. So when it relates to insulin resistance and PCOS, the most important thing to understand is, you know, in more civilian terms, is that promotes like huge inflammation, like inflammatory markers. Mm-hmm. So insulin resistance means your body starts throwing out more insulin to try to manage the carbohydrate pattern, like more than it needs, and then the insulin guys get confused and can't do anything, or it starts throwing out less and less and less. An overabundance of insulin in your system that can't be used or managed will promote inflammation and fat gain. And then the exact same is true with not enough insulin. Same deal. Obesity, fat gain, water retention, inflammation. So first and foremost, you know, it's funny, as I looked through yesterday a whole bunch of different websites about nutrition, not one of the maybe 12 nutrition sites for PCOS said what you had said earlier to me before we began this podcast, which is stopping that craziness about with foods that are inflammatory. And you have to remember what the inflammatory foods are, and here they are. Anything that is yeast, mold, and gluten-bound, and then anything that might be considered a dairy. So dairy is like eating moderately hard phlegm, first of all. It contains a maltose and lactose sugar that we cannot utilize as adults especially. And then ultimately, really, when you think about dairy consumption in the animal kingdom, we're the only animals in the entire animal kingdom that ingest dairy after birthing, because maybe Ben and Jerry's is on each corner, so stuff tastes good, but it doesn't necessarily suit us. And in fact, if you talk to those 20 athletes that we were talking to earlier and ask them, hey, you know, I came here to take your dairy order, what can I get you? None will give you an order because it inhibits the use of oxygen. It's horrible for asthma, the utilization of oxygen, and it adversely affects digestion. So if you have GERD, reflux, irritable bowel syndrome, dairy is like the devil for you. It's going to promote all kinds of inflammation and a horrible gastric distress and a bunch of gas and bloating. More gas than the Exxon Valdez held, I think. So dairy's out. And then you say, okay, well, I get the yeast and mold and gluten, but what does that mean in real foods? And that is really easy to understand. It just means that no baked goods, nothing fluffy or mashy, no bread breads, no muffins, no bagels, no hoit breads, no sandwich breads, nothing that has yeast or mold in it. So stick to the one-ingredient starches. Those multi-ingredient starches, like the bread breads, always can contain yeast and mold. Focus on the one-ingredient guys, like potatoes, rice, yams, sweet potatoes, corn, oatmeal, oat flakes, oat puffs. Look at your starches and ask them how many ingredients are in you, and if they tell you more than one, you don't get to eat it. Now, if you want a sandwich-esque thing, and it certainly does show up from time to time, I'm certainly okay with the use of like a wrap because there is no yeast in it. It's not risen, so it's just flat. Or even like the use of a pita because it is low yeast. But mostly focus on your rice and yams and sweet potatoes. And then as it relates to the reduction of inflammation, yams and sweet potatoes are fantastic choices. They actually have anti-inflammatory benefits. But the yeast, mold, and gluten, as it relates to PCOS, it's very interesting how sensitive your system and your hormonal system become to the ingestion of that. In fact, it's interesting, in just looking at some of the research, apparently, you know, I didn't know this, but it's a pretty big number. 50% of PCOS women will be type 2 diabetic by the time they hit age 40.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. That's a rough stat. And another rough stat was that 50 to 60% a woman with PCOS are trying to manage obesity. In fact, there was one medical website that said it was up to 80%. And I just find that so horrific because the information that is out there for PCOS is so contraindicated. You know, one website says consume dairy. Another one says consume grains. Another one says low glycemic, but they don't tell you what that means or how to manage it. And then they tell you to eat dairy after they tell you that. It's a web of information, and it's nice, like Amy, in talking to you, that you actually have your thumb on the pulse. It's very cool, you know. Can't say that many folks do.
Well, and I think it's just so frustrating for women with PCOS because you're right, there's so many contradictory opinions out there, and they'll go to their nutritionist and, you know, they're getting one story, and then they go online. There's another one. It's really hard, and that's, you know, being a diva. It's really about knowledge and educating yourself, and so that you can advocate for yourself. And that's why, you know, I'm doing these podcasts so that we can reach out to experts like yourself and get the information we need to make appropriate choices.
Of course. But I would say this. I would say, like, as it relates to real food choice making, that all folks with PCOS should really look at themselves from more of an athletic standpoint, because I would say that generally the majority of folks dealing with PCOS are fat and protein deficient, at which point there are some rules you got to follow. So here are the rules. No starch at night. Like, your dinner meal should be protein and vegetables only. Like, why would you consume starch in the evening when you're going to go to bed after dinner? You're not going to run a marathon. You're going to go to bed. And if you consume starch at that dinner meal, you'll store it as triglyceride fat, and that will promote the inflammation that you're trying to get rid of. Do not be afraid of starches, though, because if, in fact, you are fat and protein deficient, 25% of your food program should come from a sugar, like a starch, or fruit groupings. If you like fruit and you want to use those as snacks, always attach it to a fat to reduce the glycemic spike. As soon as you attach a protein fat grouping to a sugar, it doesn't spike you, and there's a slow rise of energy with this long chain release of energy that will provide you with a few hours of a nice energy pattern rather than spiking and dropping you like a simple sugar. So if I were to say, well, here's like a typical meal pattern, I would say, look, in the morning, have a one-ingredient starch, like oatmeal or oat flakes or oat puffs or even a wrap, and have an egg with it, or maybe two, along with a simple sugar like a fruit. A mid-morning snack, just use a simple sugar. Use a bridge to get to lunch. So it could be a fruit, like a bowl of berries, something that might be considered a lower sugar, higher fiber choice. But remember, a fruit's a fruit, and they're all sugar. So to say lower sugar is a, I don't know, a bit misleading, but it is slightly higher fiber. So let's say that. Just use a higher fiber fruit. Maybe you'll want to attach 12 almonds to it, and then you'll get a longer chain release of energy. And definitely do that if you have a tendency to push your lunch later into the afternoon, not around noon, but more like 1, 1:30, 2 o'clock. So if that's the case, and you have this long spread between breakfast and lunch, always choose a fruit and 12 almonds or a fruit and tablespoon of almond butter as a mid-morning snack. Now your lunch should have a starch in it. It should have a protein and a vegetable in it. And choose your starches wisely, like a cup of rice, a baked potato, a yam, a sweet potato, a wrap. Choose one of these guys and then have 4 ounces of protein with it, like a chicken breast, something the size of your hand from the wrist up, including your fingers, with your fingers closed, kind of sitting there in front of you. So 4 ounces of protein and then a vegetable for digestion. Maybe a garden salad, maybe something steamed, maybe something that's high iron like asparagus, spinach, or tomatoes. And then an afternoon snack, like another fruit and 12 almonds. Maintain an energy pattern. Don't be afraid of eating. Maybe late afternoon, because dinner runs late, you need just a little simple sugar to get you to dinner because of a sugar craving, perhaps. So maybe then at that point you do use a sugar like a fruit, like an apple. So after lunch, a fruit and 12 almonds. Late afternoon, if necessary, a fruit only. And then dinner, protein and vegetables only. And try to get in as much fish as you possibly can at night. The fatty acids found in fish promote a reduction of inflammation. They help liberate other fatty acids. They promote fat metabolism. Choose the fattier fish like salmon, Arctic char, black cod, sea bass, escalar. Don't be afraid of the fatty fish. They have many benefits. And then vegetables and salad with that. And then what's interesting is that after dinner, many times, just a little bit, like just up to 50 calories of simple sugar, like half a cup of berries, will spike your insulin while you sleep to promote a deep sleep, a deep hypoglycemic state sleep. And that's called stage 4 sleep. At that point, you will REM, release more growth hormone, burn more fat. So a smidge, I'm talking a tiny amount of simple sugar after dinner, will help provide that for you. It provides a great metabolic effect. And that's kind of a typical food day. And so, that helps. Does that help?
That's great. I know that's going to be really helpful for a lot of women. And I want to encourage people to pick up your book so that they can, you know, take a look and type themselves and make sure that, you know, see what their metabolism type is. There are women out there that could be dual metabolism like myself. But I did want you to kind of explain to us what happens when you skip one of those meals. I know a lot of women with PCOS skip breakfast. Often they're not eating much until dinner time. So what happens to your metabolism when you skip a meal?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'll ask many of my patients, like, hey, what happened to breakfast? Well, I wasn't hungry.
Yeah.
So remember, your food program isn't built around hunger. I don't want your hunger pattern to control your meal pattern. I want your meal pattern to control your hunger pattern. So even if you're not hungry in the morning, you establish a caloric heat pattern. And then you stabilize that heat pattern throughout the day with the proper macronutrients to provide you with an energy pattern and tissue repair so you get to the end of the day. If you skip a meal, you actually take away heat and metabolism cools. So this is interesting. There's a little bit of math, but bear with me while I talk about this real quick because it shows the importance of consistency and the importance of thumbprinting your pattern, like not skipping meals but eating a little bit of each thing just to get to the next meal type thing. So when you start a food program, you don't get hot calorically right away. It takes your body 48 hours, 2 days, to understand new heat. At the end of those 2 days, then you can start counting off your timeline or the days of the week. So you start this thing. And the first 48 hours of your food program was a no-brainer. You are focused like eye of the tiger. And then you start this thing, and then the day one is great, day two is great, day three is great. But let's say in day four, you didn't forecast so well, and you mismanaged your meals, perhaps because of a meeting, or you had to pick up the kids. It was camp because it's summer. Something goes on, and you mismanaged your food. Remember, if you mismanaged food or a meal, you mismanaged calories. If you mismanaged calories, you mismanaged heat. Metabolism will now cool. So it cools, and you lose that day that you're in for the efficient use of fat. There's 1 day lost, but do you remember how many days it takes for you to ramp up? 2 days. So you've lost the day that you're in. It'll take you another 2 days to recreate your heat pattern. You've just blown 3 days. Now, if you do that twice a week, you've lost 6 days. You've lost the week. So consistent patterning is key. And though it sounds counterintuitive, the most important thing with your nutritional indiscrepancies, like if you were to sneak something in, is that you add it into your food program and you never, ever, 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 ever substitute. So if your afternoon snack was a fruit and 12 almonds and some Starbucks cookie wrestled you to the ground and forced itself down your throat and you ate it, knock yourself out. Eat the damn thing. It's a terrible thing. I've seen it. I've watched it. I've seen it outside on the sidewalks, like the Starbucks cookie gang wrestles you to the ground. Eat the thing if you want it, but eat it for the taste. Please don't eat it because you're having a bad hair day or because your fax machine jammed or the kids are driving you nuts. Eat it because you want the flavor. And then at that point, remember, you still have a fruit and 12 almonds to eat and another perhaps late afternoon snack of a fruit only and dinner too. Don't substitute. Add in. And I promise you, you'll always add in less than you think. And across your 7 day week of food programming, always take one date night meal a week. Get it out of your system. Stop being romanced by these foods. Take your one date night meal. Eat whatever you want. You will feel horrible for the next 48 hours. You'll be in like digestive food jail hell. And then you'll kind of regroup. And slowly but surely, you'll realize, you know what? It's not that good. I don't dig it that much. So control your food pattern with meals. Let your meals regulate your hunger pattern. Don't let your hunger pattern regulate your meals. And even if you're not hungry, thumbprint that pattern. Like, take a bite of each thing, toss it aside, but don't skip your meals. If it's 11 o'clock at night and you haven't eaten meals 5, 6, and 7, get a fork. Now, you'll have a horribly difficult digestive sleep. It'll be nightmarish for you. But it teaches you a lesson, and at least you get your calories in as far as a heat pattern is concerned. So get your food in.
And I think it's so important to realize that, and you have to kind of do it through trial and error, that nothing tastes as good as feeling good feels. Once you've sort of reached that point when you really feel good, the pizza and beer, it's not going to be so enticing because you're right. You're in food hell for the rest of the evening.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
So in the few minutes we have left, I'd love for you to tell us your thoughts about hydration. I know you mentioned that as kind of your key hydration and recovery. How does hydration fit into turning up the heat?
Water is key. You know, it's interesting. The Colgate Institute of Water has come up with like some numbers, and then the National Academy of Sports Medicine has kind of followed suit behind it. So here's the rule for water consumption. The rule is, if inactive, like literally just listening to paint dry on a wall all day long and doing nothing, The rule of thumb is half an ounce of water for every pound of body weight that you weigh consumed every day. If you are active, like moving around and doing civilian things and training a couple times a week and, you know, picking up the kids and going to the bank, that type of deal, then the rule of thumb is up to 1 ounce of water for 1 pound of body weight. So if you weigh 200 pounds, your max number is 200 ounces, which is 6 liters. There are 33 ounces in a liter. And your minimum number is 100 ounces, which would be 3 liters. Now, this is why water is important. Aside from moving nutrients and toxins through your system, water regulates temperature. So as you drink water, it circulates through you. And we just naturally perspire and sweat as we consume water to regulate our temperature so we operate efficiently in different environments in our day. Now, let's say our water is low, and then our body starts to have difficulty managing temperature pattern. Our bodies will perceive that as trauma. Our bodies always hate trauma and will always try to figure out a way to adapt to make sure that we survive. Adaptive mechanisms always hoard things and collect things to protect us. The hoarding and collecting mechanism is insulatory. It's a type of thermostat, metabolic thermostat that we have. So our bodies will start to hoard fat to act as insulation to control temperature. So if your water is low, you will hoard fat. If your foods are perfect, like perfect, 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 and your water is low, you will hoard fat. So water literally is the ultimate umbrella that all the other nutrition is built underneath. Get your water in. And the more you drink, the more you will thirst. So in the beginning, you might say, Goli is nuts. I can't drink this water. This guy's out of his mind. But slowly sip on it. Know that in an hour of exercise, you should be consuming 1 liter. And if you haven't consumed a liter, sit there on a bench or something, finish your liter before you move on to the next thing. Play a game with it. And as you drink more water, you will increase your thirst pattern. And before you know it, you'll be craving the water. And you'll be drinking all the water that you need to regulate your temperature pattern. But without it, you will always fall short of body fat utilization. So water is like the Uber God, man. It runs the show. That's the water story.
So I'd like to leave listeners on a hopeful note, and there's a great quote in your book that I just wanted to read. I want women to hear this. You say, in general, I find that the female clients who come to me for nutrition coaching want to be lean and thin. These results are not always possible. However, I tell each of my clients, you have been dealt certain genetic cards. There is a lot you can do with those cards, but you cannot develop a body type that you do not possess. Instead, strive to do the best you can with what you have. Most of the time, I promise that you'll find that's pretty darn amazing. So,
that's right.
Yeah, so tell us, so women who are fat and protein efficient, you know, what is possible for their bodies?
Look, you know, the fat and protein efficient women will always be some of the most athletic females. And you always have a really nice taper, good solid muscularity, and you will be vital and have a strong, resilient immune system. Like, I am fat and protein efficient. I'm a 3-time cancer survivor. And I can promise you that type of metabolism delivers like the SUV of road vehicles. It'll deliver like the mail for you as long as you follow what your rules are. And then don't have expectations. Have an appreciation for the journey. Like, don't walk around expecting and deserving with that conversation in your head, oh, I should have this, or I expect I'll lose, blah, 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 by the end. Don't do that to yourself. It's an unnecessary conversation. Be joyful and be happy with the journey that you're on about foods, and know that you are constantly fueling and feeding your body. And that is all about self-care. Self-care is not a conversation about expecting and deserving. Self-care is checking in with yourself and asking yourself, am I leading the life I want? Like, who am I being to have the life I want? Make a list. Because if it's not the life you want, if it's not the physique you want, ask yourself, who are you being not to have that happen? And you're going to come up with the answers right away. And check in with yourself. Am I doing what I should be doing to honor who I am? Am I living fully to appreciate my entire core identity, like who I am? What is my being? And you know what? Some people will really dig it and love it, and other people won't, and who cares? As long as you love it and dig it, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and that's what being a PCOS diva is all about. It's being your authentic self and taking extreme self-care. So, gosh, what a great way to end this call. And I just want women who are listening that want to learn more about your protocol and your practice, how can they reach out to you?
Well, I think a couple of ways. You know, as I was talking with you with all this, I think that if they want to email into you and you forward me the emails, I promise I'll get back to everybody. But I'd love to establish a forum, a conversation that's ongoing, be it with just them directly I would really like to have you in the mix as we moderate the answers back and forth, because I think that's an extraordinary community, and I believe there's always power in information, and there's a lot of love and community, and you can't exchange that for anything else. And then ultimately, you know, you can always check out my website. You can always send me an email question direct. That's fine. It's philip@pfcnutrition.com. I'm literally always here at the office, man. So I'm here all the time.
Well, we will set up a FAQ then for questions that come in and your answers, and we can kind of share them with everyone in an FAQ on PCOS Diva. I think that sounds great.
That'd be great.
So thank you, Dr. Golia, and thank you for everyone listening. Until next time.